She said the word Vermont like it was a magical, fictional place of ill repute. To be fair, it was a bit, at least in Stevie's corner of Vermont.
I've heard of Ellingham, Angela said, tearing a piece of the bread with gusto. The kidnapping in the 1930s? They never solved that, did they? Or something happened recently, maybe.
That was Stevie,
Izzy said, passing around the condiments on a tray. She didn't clarify, and Angela didn't ask. It was better that way. Stevie was already in a stranger's house, holding a massive plate of food, slightly stupefied with exhaustion. She was not prepared to give a talk on her detecting. She wanted to eat, avoid burping, make out with her boyfriend, and possibly fall asleep on the floor. To Stevie's surprise, Izzy began to recount the story of Stevie's work on the Ellingham kidnapping and murders, even the stuff that hadn't been in the press. She told the story of the truly devious letters and the recent deaths. These were things she could have learned only from David. She knew these things in detail, and she got the details right. This told Stevie a few things. One, David talked about Stevie a lot. Two, Izzy paid attention. Three, Izzy made it sound like Stevie was Wikipedia Holmes, a walking, talking, deducing database that ate true crime and spat out justice.
Oh, Angela said in reply when Izzy had concluded. I see. That's really quite something.
It was sort of flattering, but some other darker emotion was slipping into Stevie's brain pan. Why did Izzy care so much about her? Was it just to bring her here to talk to her aunt, or was it to build trust with David?
Oh, your girlfriend, tell me all about her.
Stevie suddenly conjured images of long nights at the pub, their feet touching under the table, Izzy's intent and interested expression. She had warm brown eyes, that soft halo of hair, a dimple on her left cheek, and she was smart. She had been talking with Vi on the tube about international politics. Vi's and Izzy's interests overlapped a bit. Environmental justice, food insecurity, the political implications of prisons. Izzy had started learning Japanese online, and Vi, who had studied it a bit longer, was giving her some tips. Izzy was the full package. Warm and vibrant and smart and engaged. She was with David all the time. And then there was Stevie. Far away in America. No future plan, and no idea how to fix the planet. She couldn't even figure out how to cut her hair. There was a loud burst of pops outside, like a scatter of gunfire, and Stevie saw a glint of yellow light. Having participated in school shooter drills since she was in kindergarten, she almost reflexively scooted herself under the window and out of view.
Nothing to be alarmed about, Angela said, reaching for some more chutney. Those are just leftover fireworks from Bonfire Night. Someone keeps setting them off in their garden.
Do you know Bonfire Night?
Izzy asked.
Remember, remember, the 5th of November. Gunpowder, treason, and plot.
Vaguely, Janelle said.
Stevie had heard of it in the many English mystery books she read. She knew there was something about a mannequin, but never really understood what it was about.
Henry VIII, Angela said. You probably know that he had 6 wives. When he wanted to leave his first wife, Catherine of Aragon, to marry Anne Boleyn, the church wouldn't let him do it. After fighting with them for years, he broke with the Catholic Church and declared himself head of the church in England. He destroyed 1,000 years of the Roman Catholic Church's rule in England. He dissolved the monasteries. He took all the wealth the church had, which was a lot. This change in religion caused turmoil for decades. Catholics and Protestants fighting for control of the crown. And in 1605, a group of Catholic zealots launched a conspiracy to blow up Parliament and the king. Guy Fawkes was found hiding under Parliament with 36 barrels of gunpowder. Things didn't go well for him. They tortured him until he gave up his confederates.
Nobby, no!
Doorknob had settled his happy orange bulk on Stevie's coat and was sucking on one of the buttons. As soon as Angela moved to get up, he jumped off and skittered up the steps.
He does that, Angela said. Likes to chew buttons off things.
Buttons, zips, laces. Sorry.
Tea?
Izzy suddenly popped up off the floor and grabbed some dirty plates. Anyone? I'll make tea. She hurried out of the room.
You're going to the tower tomorrow?
Angela asked.
That's where they tortured him.
I'm going to be doing some filming there in a few weeks. I'm one of those people who host historical documentaries, or I appear in them.
Izzy may have mentioned that.
This one is another program about the wives of Henry VIII. There is an insatiable appetite for things about the wives of Henry VIII. Everyone loves them. Sex and murder.
Murder? Stevie said.
How else would you describe killing two of your wives? It was a good point, and Stevie felt stupid for having said the word like it was a question. Her brain was slow.
It's the thing people always want to know about, Angela said. Here's a king so smitten by a woman that he smashes everything to marry her. And he does so in November 1532. She doesn't give him a son. Within about 2 years, he's discussing how to get rid of her. He takes a mistress. He's already got her successor picked out. In order to have this new wife, the old wife has to go. And she's not going to go with all the fuss of the first one. I mean, he's just blown the world apart, ripped religion and world order to shreds, so he can't just admit that she didn't work out for him. He's got to erase Anne. She said it with genuine distaste.
So she was arrested on mostly, if not entirely, trumped-up charges of infidelity, including the charge that she was in a relationship with her brother.
Yikes, Bai said.
Yikes indeed. The king wanted her gone, so she was going to be gone, no matter what it took. The more disgraceful, the better. There could be no questions. Anne was taken to the tower after her arrest. They'll probably tell you in the tour she came in by the traitor's gate. But that's not right. In any case, she's imprisoned there. Henry's already off having a good time with his new love. It all ended quickly, within about 2 weeks, in May 1536. She was arrested on the 2nd. All the men she was accused of having affairs with were taken off for questioning. That means they were tortured. Anne was tried and found guilty on the 15th. The men were executed on the 17th, and she was set to die on the 19th.
17 days.
That's all it took from being a queen to being accused, imprisoned, tried, and executed. The king gave her a going-away present, so to speak. The punishment for the crime that she'd been convicted of was burning at the stake, for women. Because she was a queen, he decided that wasn't appropriate for her. She would be beheaded, but a simple beheading also wasn't enough. He sent for a special executioner from France who used a sword. He did this, mind you, before she was found guilty, almost as if he knew how it was all going to end. Another smaller flash and pop outside.
Here's a little grim fact, Angela went on.
The tower is big on those. With beheadings by axe, you had to put your head down on a block. Like this. She demonstrated by leaning forward and tilting her head to the side, like she was setting it down on something. But beheadings by sword were different. You knelt, but you kept your head up. When Anne climbed the scaffold after she spoke, and she gave a moving speech, she had to remove her cloak, her headdress, all her jewels. She even had to pay her own executioner with a bag of money she had been provided and formally forgave him. That was all procedure. But it always affects me when I think about it. They put a cap on her head, knelt her down, put a blindfold over her eyes. Now she can't see. The executioner, to his credit, is good at what he does. He has a method he uses to get his victim's head in the right position. He calls to his boy to bring him his sword, except there is no boy. He's already got the sword. He does this because the victims will naturally turn their head in the direction he's calling, waiting to hear the sword being brought to the scaffold. It seems so simple, this little misdirection, but it works. A little bit of fakery did so much. One swing of the sword was all it took. What's odd is after all that, the trials and torture and bringing a swordsman from France, no one planned for the body. The body they knew would be there. No one had arranged for a coffin. One of the yeomen had to go to the armory and find a box. Izzy came in with a tray full of steaming mismatched mugs, along with a wrapped roll of chocolate hobnob cookies. She distributed the mugs, handing Stevie a pink polka-dotted one. As a coda to all of that, Angela said, accepting a mug of tea. Henry didn't bother with the swordsman for the murder of his fifth wife, Catherine Howard, 6 years later. He let them use the axe. The word axe seemed to be the perfect jumping-in point. Stevie saw Izzy reaching for the conversational baton.
You know, she said, passing teas to the others. I was telling Stevie, because she's done work in this area, real work, like I said. Here's milk, Vi. Do you take sugar? I'll leave it here. About what happened to you, with your friends, you know, the murders.
9. Angela stiffened her grip on her mug. It was not a graceful transition of topic. One did not simply mention the murders.
I know, Izzy said quickly. It's very hard for you, but since Stevie is, well, an expert in these things, and it was never solved.
Again, she waited for Angela to take the lead, but she did not. Despite what Izzy had told them, Angela clearly had no idea this was going to happen. Angela didn't know they were coming, didn't know she would be giving a history lesson, didn't know about dinner, and hadn't expected to talk about what must have been one of the most terrible days of her life.
Izzy.
It really is all right, Izzy said, even though it was not for her to say what was or wasn't right for Angela.
Janelle shifted in deep discomfort. Vi stared into the remains of the chickpea curry on their plate. Nate was so utterly expressionless that he was no longer with them in spirit. He had moved on to some other plane of existence. Even David gave Stevie a bit of concerned side-eye.
When I was leaving uni, Angela explained, two friends of mine were killed. It was horrible. It was a burglary. They never found out who did it. For obvious reasons, I don't like talking about it.
Which was fair. But there was something in her manner that suggested otherwise. She had moved to the edge of her seat on the sofa. She wanted desperately to talk, but she was stopping herself. Was Stevie the only one seeing this? The surefire way to get someone to tell you something you want to know isn't to ask them about it. What you do is start telling the story yourself, say what you think happened, and say it wrong. People may not want to discuss things, but they will correct you every time.
I think I read about this, Stevie said.
You did? Angela said.
It didn't turn up much in the news. I doubt you've heard about it. Something about a game, at a manor, hide and seek, and someone drowned?
Izzy opened her mouth to correct Stevie, then seemed to realize what was going on and shut it.
No, Angela said. Well, there was a game. It happened at a manor, but...
In a pool? Stevie went on. This was intolerable to Angela, both as the friend of the victims and as a professional historian. She couldn't sit there and let this wrongness go on. She got up and went up the steps.
Uh-oh, Vi said.
Angela returned half a minute later with a small framed item, which she passed to Stevie. It was a poster, hand-lettered, photocopied on mustard-colored paper. The Nine presents Bingo Hall Sex Party. 45 minutes of sketch comedy that your auntie wouldn't like. There was a photo on the page, obviously a print photo that had been photocopied, so it was in black and white and not very sharp. Still, Stevie could make out clearly enough that these were nine people who wanted you to know this was comedy. They each wore a costume, but none that related to any of the others. There was a tall woman in a dirty formal dress. One was wearing a top hat. One of the guys was wearing nothing at all and had a bingo ball turner strategically placed over his groin.
What happened was this, Angela said. When I was at Cambridge, I was in a theatrical group. There were nine of us. We met during Freshers Week and at some auditions in our first year, and we all became friends. We wrote and performed shows together.
The Nine? Stevie asked.
That was what we were called, Angela said. Despite how this looks, we weren't bad. We weren't the footlights or anything like that. But we had a good following. We went to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival twice and did well. Suze, she pointed to the tall woman dressed in the tattered evening gown, is an actress. She does quite a lot of Shakespeare, occasional television. She's always working. She's an amazing impressionist. And Yash and Peter? She pointed at the guy wearing nothing and holding up the bingo balls, along with the guy in the cowboy outfit. That's Peter, the naked one. And that's Yash in the hat. They're a writing team, and they work on loads of shows, comedy panel shows, sitcoms, all kinds of things. In fact, Peter and Yash just won an award for their latest show the other week. They're always doing that. So at least three of us ended up performing, and I do some television work, so that's four, I suppose. Anyway, we got a house together in our third year, all nine of us. We were each other's entire lives, really. Sebastian's family had a big house in the country called Merriweather. We would go there sometimes after term. Our final year, after exams, Sebastian invited us there for a graduation party week. His family had gone away to their other house in Greece, so the house was all ours. On the night we arrived, we were playing a game, a group hide-and-seek. We played it all the time. One person would start as the seeker, and as each person was found, they'd join the seeker team, until only one person was left. We played until the early morning hours, but we went inside after the storm became too intense. Two of my friends, Rosie and Noel, we didn't realize they were missing at first. We assumed they were... that they wanted time to themselves. In the morning, we found them in the woodshed. They'd disturbed burglars in the night, or the burglars disturbed them. Either way, they were killed with a wood axe from the shed. They never found who did it. That is the story. But what about the lock? Izzy said. Angela didn't exactly scream or throw a plate across the room, but the word lock had a chilling effect on her. She cocked her head to the side. For a moment, she made no reply before coughing out a, what? The lock, Izzy repeated. Your friends were found in a woodshed that was supposed to be locked. You told me. You said the lock was off the door in the night. The color was draining from Angela's face.
When did I ever say that?
When I was staying with you after you had that surgery on your knee, earlier this year. The mood in the room changed completely.
There's nothing about a lock, Angela replied in a way that made it clear that there was something going on with the lock.
You said something about planted evidence, and that...
Angela was no longer trying to disguise her discomfort.
It was strong medication, Izzy.
You said you thought one of your friends was a murderer. I know this is terrible for you, but it was real. I could see it was real. Stevie can help. She's done this before.
Doorknob worked the ankles of the assembled as the awkward silence fell over the group. That had effectively cut the conversation off. There would be no more talk of murder.
I hate to be rude, Angela said. But I have an early call in the morning and more work to finish up tonight.
What did you think?
Izzy said when they were back on the street and walking toward the tube entrance.
It was...
What had it been? Evasive, for sure. But evasion was a reasonable response to a group of foreign teenagers showing up at your door unannounced and then being asked to talk about the greatest trauma in your life. But there was something there. A look in Angela's eye when that lock was mentioned.
The lock had not been conjured out of prescription opiates. The lock was real, or it was a genuine memory. The memory might be faulty, it might be irrelevant, but it was one she'd had long before she took her pain medication, and it was one she had right now. It had conjured something in Angela that Stevie couldn't place. It was odd, wasn't it? Izzy went on. She didn't want to talk about that lock. There's something there, isn't there? I wish you saw what I did when she was on those painkillers.
The ride back was less crowded, but Stevie found that the food had settled happily in her belly, and now her body was sedate. The train rocked. London whipped past in a series of tube stop names, and flashes of tile and tunnel and people.
She sat in one of the upholstered train seats. Fabric seats on a subway? That seemed risky. What lived on these seats? She put her head on David's shoulder and began to drift.
Hey.
The shoulder bumped, and Stevie snapped up her head with an audible snort.
We're here.
Stevie had heard of jet lag, but she didn't really jet that much, so she was not sure what the lag was supposed to feel like. Apparently, this was it. You just fell asleep. She was in a stupor, dragging herself along back to Craven House.
Your toast,
David said, running a finger along the edge of her chin when they got back.
You're going to crash. Jet lag is worse the second day. I have some work to do tonight. You should sleep.
She didn't want to be tired. She wanted to go somewhere with him now, but it wasn't happening. Her body was turning out the lights for the night.
Tomorrow, he said, after you're done. Want to go on a date?
A what?
I know, right? A real date.
Gross, she said. He smiled, kissed her, and she dragged herself into the elevator with the others. Once in her room, she pulled off her clothes as she walked and flopped onto the bed. She listened to the squeak of the plastic against the frame, looked at the corona of light coming from the street lamp outside. Someone kicked a glass bottle on the street, and people were laughing. Her stomach was full of curry. Her hormones were dancing, and her vision was blurring from exhaustion.
There's nothing about a lock. It was strong medication, Izzy.
Angela was lying to them. Why? Why bother lying when she could have been dismissive? Why say there's nothing about a lock when everything about your voice and body says there was definitely something about a lock, and that the lock was important? As she winked out of consciousness, Stevie caught the tail end of a realization. She knew the emotion she'd seen playing over Angela's features as she'd been telling her story. It wasn't sadness about what had happened, or annoyance that she was being prodded to tell a traumatic story to a bunch of strange teenagers in her house. It was fear. Excerpt from the witness statement of Angela Gill. 24 June, 1995. Interviewer.
Can you describe the nature of the group here at the manor right now?
Angela Gill.
We're housemates at Cambridge, and we have a theater group. We're celebrating graduation. We were celebrating.
And you arrived at what time last evening?
Almost 10.
And this game you were playing started?
Around 11. We were picking rooms and chatting, and then we started when it got dark.
Where did you go at the start of the game?
I went out the main door in the front. Rosie went out that way as well.
Did anyone else go out that way?
No, it was just the two of us.
And then where did you go?
Rosie went to the left, toward the drive and the woods. I went straight ahead. I almost fell over the ha-ha. I realized I'd made a bad choice running that way, so I looped round, behind the stables, to the back of the house and hid in the garden. After an hour or so, I got tired of being in the mud, so I crawled out to find another place to hide, somewhere warmer. That's when I went past the woodshed.
Did you try to get inside?
No.
Why not?
Sebastian said it was locked.
But did you see if it was locked?
Silence on tape.
Miss Gill?
Silence on tape.
Miss Gill, was there something about the lock on the woodshed?
No, I'm sorry. I feel quite... The lock was secure, quite secure, during the game. Yes, I saw it. It was locked.
10. The Tower of London, Stevie was embarrassed to find, was not a tower. The name was misleading. So many things she was told to expect in life did not pan out as she anticipated. What this thing was a massive stone boundary wall, with turrets along it and a grassy ditch where a mast used to be, and inside a dozen or more peaks and towers and structures of all kinds. And this whole thing sat in the middle of a congested business district, within sight of the glass towers, actual towers, of modern London.
We are supposed to budget about 2 to 3 hours for this, Janelle said, consulting her phone as they waited in line for the opening for the day. But we have the old city of London tour at 1, and it's almost 10 now, so I guess we should try to do this in 2, so that we can eat and send our first video report. Everyone has the tour app downloaded, right?
Stevie gulped at her coffee and stared over at the iconic Tower Bridge, the one that was on all the posters and pictures. There were carts selling magnets and tea towels and phone cases with the Union Jack flag on them, the sure sign that this was the place for them. They were capital T tourists, and eventually they would be worn down and get a shirt or a hoodie that said London on the front.
There's nothing about a lock. It was strong medication, Izzy.
On one hand, Angela was a witness to a crime. A crime she wanted to leave in the past, that's what she said. She wanted no part of this tale she supposedly told when on pain medication. But that was the thing. The discordant note, the problem. In this case, the problem of the lock. She could see it in her mind. A hunk of metal with a loop on the top, opened with a key on the bottom. Your average padlock, holding closed a piece of metal on a wooden door. And the idea of it terrified Angela. Why? The line began to move forward. Stevie tripped over a crack in the sidewalk, and milk foam flew out of the coffee hole, some going up her nose, a bit more onto the sleeve of her coat, and a disappointing amount down her front. She found herself about to lick the sleeve when she caught herself. Travel was making her disgusting.
"Happening already, huh?"
Nate said, falling into step next to her.
"What?" "The murder story from last night. You're gone already."
"I'm not gone. Besides, who kills their friends with an axe?"
"That seems like a strange thing to say, considering what we've seen."
"Yeah, but we didn't see axe murders. That's messed up. I mean, all murder is messed up, but that's really messed up. Angela was high on pain medication. It's probably nothing."
"I know you think it's a thing because you haven't said a word all morning, and you were just about to lick your sleeve." "Yeah, I saw that. This is how you get."
"Doesn't matter if I am or I'm not. There's not a lot I can do about it."
"That's never stopped you before."
Stevie paid her admission, which was breathtakingly expensive. Now that she had a little to spend, she noticed how quickly it went. Nate was behind her, and as he tapped his card, the machine made a noise of disapproval. He tried again.
"That card isn't working," the person in the booth said. "Do you have another?"
He
scrambled for his wallet, which contained a single 20-pound note, which was not enough. "Here," Stevie said, tapping her card for him. "Pay me later."
"Thanks," Nate said. "I think I messed up the chip or something."
He smiled weakly, but there was a crinkling in the corners of his eyes that struck Stevie as odd, like he was worried about the card. Nate had money. Nate probably had more money than any of them. He had a book out. She didn't know how much he made from it, but it was probably substantial. And they had all gotten paid for their work at the camp over the summer. Not a fortune, but it had been decent. She was reading too much into it. Once through the main tower gate, they found themselves in the walled complex, almost an entire town. The Salt Tower, the Broad Arrow Tower, the Martin Tower, the Brick Tower, the Flint Tower, the Beauchamp Tower. All these strung together by battlements and interwoven with lanes and greens and paths. The voice on the app breathlessly said that the tower was still technically a royal residence. It had been a palace, a defensive structure, a torture chamber, a munitions site. The tower had served as a jail for everyone imaginable, from unrepentant religious leaders to World War I spies to deposed royalty to actual sorcerers who scratched cosmic guides on the walls. It was protected by beef-eaters, or yeoman guards, who got to live there in one of the many charming residences that lined the walls. They even had their own private pub, full of historical relics. This place had seen over 1,000 years of rains and wars, and bloodshed, and millions of tourists. It had even, the voice on the tour app continued, been host to an entire zoo for hundreds of years, because what else do you give to royalty who have everything? You give them baboons, leopards, tigers, an elephant or two.
At one point, someone gave one of the kings a polar bear, which he put on a leash and took down to the Thames to fish. Because when you're king, you have weird pastimes. But for most of those hundreds of years, no one knew how to take care of the animals. So the monkeys kept biting everyone. The lion ate someone. And the keepers thought ostriches could eat anything, so they fed them metal. Eventually, the death zoo was closed and relocated to an actual zoo. The audio started to devolve into dates and kings, various Henrys and Charleses, or Richards, or Edwards, or whoever who lived or died there, who each built a tower or a chapel, until the place turned into such a maze that if you tried to attack it, you'd get lost inside, chasing whatever Henry or Charles or Edward owned the place at the time. Stevie tried, but she couldn't get herself interested in who had a bed here in 1300-something, or why the fireplace mattered. Angela had tried to explain the significance of a lot of this last night. But once they got on the subject of murder, Stevie overwrote all those mental files. That information was gone. The doors, however, attracted her. These were heavy doors, several inches thick, with great big locks.
There's nothing about a lock.
They left whichever tower they had just come through and were back out on the paths that wound around the tower. I need to pee, Vi said. And more coffee. The tower had multiple cafes and stalls within its walls. Nothing completed an 11th century fortress like a cappuccino, after all. One of the yeoman guards stepped out in his distinctive hat and uniform with a plastic container. This, a tour guide pointed out to a nearby group, was the Raven Master, in charge of the ravens that were always in residence at the tower.
Raven Master?
Nate repeated.
Raven Master.
The Raven Master proceeded to offer his ravens their favorite snacks, which included biscuits soaked in blood.
Gross job, Nate added. Still, best name.
Blood? Stevie asked.
Just blood? Loose blood?
They should really say where they're getting the blood.
Never explain where you get the blood,
Nate replied, looking at Stevie enigmatically.
And now, the tour guide said, the spot everyone wants to see. This is Tower Green, the site of the execution of some of the tower's most famous prisoners. These include Lady Jane Grey, the Nine-Day Queen, and Anne Boleyn, the second wife of Henry VIII.
This was a true privilege, as most of the poor bastards imprisoned in the tower, not the exact words of the tour guide, were taken out to Tower Hill to be killed in public. Only fancy people got to die on Tower Green. There was artwork there now, a glass cushion, representing where they put their head for the executioner. Everything in Stevie's mind meshed itself into a single fabric. The Tower of London to Izzy's aunt to Henry VIII, and these poor students who were cut to pieces with an axe in the 90s. It wasn't hard to follow this mental path, especially as the guide went into gleeful detail about how the severed heads used to be displayed outside and on the bridge, just so prisoners knew what was in store for them.
Here for a bad time, Nate said. Not for a long time.
Janelle and Vi appeared from around a corner without coffee. Line was too long, Vi said, a strange smile on their face. This may or may not have been true. Clearly, they had slipped off for a minute to be romantic and adorable, maybe to make out or take pics of themselves.
It's the jewels next, Janelle said, consulting the app. Then the White Tower, that's this big one. And then we're done.
They went into a large building that was dark and heavily guarded by real soldiers with real guns. They saw the crown jewels.
Magic hats, Nate said. Magic wands, magic orbs, magic spoons. This is all wizard stuff.
Literally, all of this was stolen, Vi added. Then it was into the White Tower, the dominating structure at the center of the complex. This was an old palace, a fortress. Janelle couldn't help but admire all the armor.
Its clothes and its metalwork.
There was even a little murder mystery corner for Stevie. The place where the bones of two children were found, assumed to be the lost princes of the tower, the ones supposedly murdered by Richard III. As they wound out, there were the rooms of weapons, cannonballs and weapons. The tour cheerfully ended in the torture chamber, where they saw the rack, the manacles, and something called the scavenger's daughter that compressed people until they juiced. Like lemons. After 2 hours of this, Stevie's brain was raw from towers and cannonballs and ravens and kings. They found a place with Wi-Fi to get in touch with Ellingham and give Dr. Branfield from the history department their observations about what they'd seen. Vi had clearly been paying the most attention and gave a detailed report of many of their observations of pillage, detailing the jewels and where they had all come from. There was time enough for a quick sandwich. Then it was another walking tour, this one of the old city of London, covering the square mile at its heart. She was not paying attention to the fragments of Roman wall, the magical stone called the London Stone that was hidden behind a bit of grating, or the recreation of the Roman temple that was now located under an office building. London refused to stop. The main lesson of all the tours and the buildings and the dates and the spires and statues and stones was that everything took a long time to build, and then it would burn. Or someone wanted a new, different thing and would continue building the thing in some other style. Everyone died in a plague? No problem. Build on a plague pit. The dead were stacked under them in some kind of archaeological 7-layer dip. Every once in a while, someone would try to repair a road and up came a skeleton, waving a bony hello. It happened so often they had teams of archaeologists to deal with it. Death, plague, destruction, torture, beheadings. Merry old England. She couldn't help but admire the mastery of Izzy's play. Izzy had set her up to hear Angela's story and to hear Angela talk about this place of beheading and violence and torment. Once you start thinking about murder by axe, you tend to keep thinking about murder by axe. Axe murder is serious business. In the tower, it was a brutal message and vengeful justice. It was rare in most murder mysteries. Axes were scary movie territory. Someone might sneak around with a knife or a gun or a bottle of poison. But someone will notice your axe. In this case, it sounded like a weapon of convenience. It was in the shed, most likely, since it was a woodshed. If someone in that group of nine had murdered two of the others, it must have been on the spur of the moment. Also, there was the practicality of it. How did one person with an axe murder two people in a shed? Was it a crazed bloodbath? Why didn't the two take on the one? What was it Angela had said? A little bit of fakery. That's what the swordsman had used to get Anne to turn her head to make it easier to kill her. Maybe that's all it took to murder someone and get away with it. A little bit of fakery. 11. When they arrived at Craven House, having walked many miles and thousands of years through London, David was waiting for them in the lounge. He was wearing a dress shirt and a tie and already had the coat on. He had been curating a mist of shade around his jawline. Somehow it never got to stubble. Between that and the way he leaned back on the steps, stretching out his legs, he knew exactly what he was doing.
"Hey, sicko,"
he said, getting up to kiss Stevie on the lips. That feeling never got old. That moment of contact. Feeling that warm puff of air from his nose, the softness of his mouth, the way he reached around to cradle the back of her head, his fingers in her short hair.
"Ready to go?"
"Now? Could I..."
5 minutes, Belle, then we ride.
"Where are we going?"
"Another surprise," he said with a wolfish grin.
Again, they were going to walk, taking the same path they had the other night, snaking down the streets. There was a special pleasure in knowing the path a bit now. It was already a little familiar.
"You keep looking at me weird,"
he said. You look good. You're all dressed up, and, you know, the coat."
"You only like me for my coat,"
he said. "Yep," she replied. "It's a long game I'm playing to get that coat."
"Starts at 5, he said.
"What does?" He shook his head. They went to Embankment Station and took the Circle Line, which was a yellow spaghetti on the map, one that was twinned with the Green District Line. They took the eastbound train, getting off in a few stops at a place called Oldgate. He walked her down a wide commercial street mixed with large modern office buildings made of glass, countless construction sites, some older, ornate places of gold brick, several betting shops, and a Burger King.
Seriously, she said.
Almost there.
As soon as she saw the first sign that said Whitechapel, she knew. They turned a corner and found many people milling around. All tourists like her.
This way for the original tour, a man in a top hat said. Tickets are available. You should have a code if you bought online, so please have your mobile out so I can scan it and we can be on our way.
Is this a Jack the Ripper tour?
Nothing's too murdery for my princess, he said. I even coordinated with Janelle.
David held out his phone and allowed the jowly man with the shock of long white hair to check them in. Like any person who followed true crime, Stevie knew the basics of the Jack the Ripper case. London, 1888. A man haunted the streets and killed sex workers, women who were poor and trying to survive. He was famous for his rapid mutilations, some in places where he could easily have been discovered. But what he really was some dirtbag. The press had given him the nickname Jack the Ripper, and the case had been pumped up in the press. There was debate about how many victims he had, but most people had settled on 5. Now he was a spooky folk hero. She had, by now, been on a lot of tours. Unlike the other places she had been visiting, there were no fine buildings on this walk. No towers or turrets, no marble busts or spires. Henry III had never come this way. Instead, this walk led them down some pretty mundane streets in East London, mostly deserted for the night. They walked past fried chicken places, banks, pubs, vape shops, fabric stores. Most of them were closed. There were streets of old warehouses of brown brick, now converted into luxury flats. The guide gave a low-key summary of the socioeconomic conditions of Victorian-era London and the fact that the canonical victims of Jack the Ripper had been forced into sex work because they needed to eat. Many were addicted to the cheap gin that was sold absolutely everywhere and was the only thing that made the rough life on the streets of the East End at all bearable. Except he didn't say it quite that way, and he didn't call the victims sex workers. People had come for the murders. People always come for the murders. Stevie had to admit that she was one of the people who had come for the murders, but it was not as simple as that.
For weeks, all was quiet, the guide said dramatically. Then on the 30th of September, 1888, Jack the Ripper struck twice in one night, twice in just 45 minutes, in what is now known as the double event. It was a vicious, miserable night. Raining and hailing, gale winds.
There was a buzzing noise coming from David's coat pocket.
How does he do it? How does he kill 2 people in 2 different parts of town in that shorter time? How does he do his evil surgery in the dark of Mitre Square? Is he a phantom?
No, Stevie said to herself. Murder stories were always about the same thing at their heart. Some twerp thought it was acceptable to take the life of another person. Murderers were small inside. People had died here, and they died because they were poor and vulnerable. More buzzing. Who is that? She asked.
Izzy,
he said, looking down at his texts.
Murderers are shadows, the man said. That's their defining quality.
Murderers are assholes, Stevie said, just loud enough to be heard. That's their defining quality. Someone turned. The guide gave a wry smile that suggested that he had met her ilk before, these young people with their ideas about society, and he found it amusing. As he moved the group along, Stevie put her hand on David's arm and held him back. I really appreciate this, she said, but...
No, I've been wincing for the last half hour. There were some other Jack the Ripper tours, but I went with this one because the guy had a hat. I think maybe I picked a bad one. This was a hat-based mistake.
What does that even mean? Murderers are shadows, Stevie said to David.
Who the fuck knows? Well, seems like we have some time then. How about dinner and some light entertainment? I can think of a few fun things to do.
And there it was. The spark. The electric moment. This was the night. She could sense it now.
She could feel the energy coming off the golden brown bricks of the Victorian warehouses that were now apartments. The orange glow of the lights. The people slipping down the dark streets on electric scooters. It would happen. Except his phone kept buzzing. He pulled it out of his pocket, thumbed a reply, and dropped it back in.
Sorry, he said. Izzy's freaked out.
About what?
Her aunt hasn't replied to her texts. She's worried that she's mad about last night.
Yeah, Stevie said. I think she might be. I think Izzy kind of sprang all of that on her.
There's nothing about a lock. It was strong medication, Izzy.
Come on, he said. He wrapped his arm around her shoulders and took comically long steps, walking toward the tube stop they'd passed a few minutes back.
I know where we should go. I'm taking you to the best restaurant in all of London.
It was called Ali's of London. It was, again, a plain white storefront with bright fluorescent lights, with a TV mounted on the wall playing a soccer match. In the window, there was a rotating vertical spit of roasted meat, off which one of the men behind the counter was expertly slicing thin pieces. David leaned against the counter with both hands, watching him work.
Ali is an artist, he said. Look.
Ali smiled and held up a slice of the meat. It was so thin you could almost see through it. As someone who had worked a deli counter for 2 weeks over the summer, she knew good meat slicing when she saw it.
This, David said, is the food that keeps England running. This is the doner kebab. It is magnificent. Look.
Another man was slapping flatbreads on the grill. The smell of the warm bread and the meat was intoxicating.
People say fish and chips, David went on. No. People say sausages and mash. No. It's the doner kebab. He's right,
Ali said as the man at the grill dropped the flatbread into a styrofoam clamshell.
You want everything? She wants everything, David said. This is my girlfriend, from America. She's a famous detective. Oh, yeah?
Ali nodded absently as the kebab was loaded down with shredded lettuce and red cabbage, sliced tomatoes, cucumbers, pickled peppers, and squirted with a white sauce. The two containers were ready, and Ali rang them up. David reached for his wallet, but Stevie swatted his arm. I've got it, she said.
Famous detective,
David said again.
Good,
Ali said approvingly.
You should marry her. Maybe I will,
David said with a smile as he scooped up the containers. What?
What?
It was a joke, of course. Something shouted by a man with a sandwich, but David had answered. He'd said yes. Could you joke about that? What did it mean? They went to sit on a bench at the riverside, despite the slight spittle of rain that had started.
It's seasoning, he explained. Everything here tastes better with it. You start to get used to it. You start to think it's warm out when it's only kind of cold, and that a little rain isn't rain.
Is this how you normally eat? Sandwiches in the rain?
I am eating fancy this week because you are here. Most nights I eat spaghetti from a can. Go on, try it. Eat the art.
Stevie tried to pick up the massive gyro neatly, but this was impossible. She leaned in to take a bite. It was as good as promised, fatty and garlicky and messy.
You see, he said, the best meal in town.
They ate for a moment or two. Stevie found that she was starving from all the walking in the cold.
He made me an offer,
David said before he took another massive bite of the sandwich. Your dad? A heavy nod.
Yep.
He wiped some gyro from the side of his mouth.
He cut off all money months ago. No school money, nothing. But he called me 2 weeks ago. He offered to pay my tuition if I stay here and finish school. He said it was because I was doing well here, but he wants me out of the country. I'm a liability. If he can keep me out of the U.S. for 3 years, that's one less thing to worry about.
Stevie's heart was fluttering nervously. They had danced around the topic of David's school. This was only supposed to be a semester abroad. It was almost over. And now...
I do like it here, he said. But I don't want his money. I told him I would see him at Christmas and hung up.
So you're not...
There are good things about being here. I like it. I really do. And I like being away from him. But you live kind of far, which I don't like. What about you? I mean, I know you're not sure yet. I mean, you've never mentioned anywhere you wanted to go. You could study here. They have good criminology programs here.
Yeah, but how? She said.
How what?
I don't know how to get the money for that,
or how to set it up. My grades are fine. They're okay, mostly. But I don't know if I'd get in.
I got in.
It's easier for you. Your dad may suck, but it does make things easier for you. It came out badly. I mean,
I know what you mean,
he said. He didn't seem mad about it.
You've solved murders,
he said.
I don't solve murders. I just hang around with someone who does.
Yeah, but that's not something colleges ask. There's no question about how many murders you've solved.
David regarded her curiously for a long moment.
You don't get it, do you?
He said.
You really don't.
What? You think I'm being modest or something?
Something.
I'm not, she said. I like myself fine, but I'm confusing for colleges. I've done stuff, but I also missed a lot of classes on the way. I'm not Janelle.
No one's Janelle. Maybe not even Janelle.
I don't speak multiple languages. I don't know about art. I don't play an instrument. Unless there's some kind of true crime quiz on the application, I may be screwed. I only applied to Ellingham because I knew that case. Suddenly, she could no longer finish her massive sandwich. It had been delicious and garlicky and full of tasty, oozing things. But the concept of the future had stripped her of her appetite. She got up and threw the remainder of the sandwich in the trash, feeling bad about the waste. She went over to the wall that ran along the riverside and leaned her elbows on it. The famous Thames. Her mental image of the Thames had come from TV and books, and she had compressed it, making it quaint and pleasant. The real Thames was wide, with a powerful current, full of large vessels. It smelled faintly of the sea, or at least some primal element. It splashed against the supporting walls. It was a tough river. David came over and opened his coat, invited her inside. She hugged him by the waist and pressed her head into his chest.
Fuck, she said quietly. I hate it. Hate what?
Not having everyone around me. Forever. I want to be with you. And Janelle and Nate and Vi, and that's not going to happen.
Yeah, but you're here. We'll figure it out. Come on, look, you're in London. We're supposed to be having fun. Do you want to have fun?
What kind of fun?
She said, lifting her head to look at him.
I can think of lots of fun things to do.
Stevie could feel his heart rate increase, and hers sped up to match it. This was it. It was time to have the conversation. David was fully here with her right now, and they could do anything.
I need to ask you something, she said. Have you?
She had worked this out in her mind, how to ask this. It was a straightforward question. Well, it had straightforward aspects. Have you had sex before? But now that the moment was here and she was supposed to say this in actual words that came out of her actual mouth, they had been reduced to particles, blown apart in the winds of meaning. What counted as sex? What precisely did she mean? And then, if the answer was yes, she had always been pretty sure the answer would be yes, what then? Did she continue the line of questioning like she was in court? What kind of sex, and what exactly, and with who, and how many times, and can you draw the locations on this map? He was still waiting for the rest of the question. He had a twitching half-smile. Did he know what she wanted to ask, and did he find it funny? Or was he really waiting to see what the hell she wanted, because have you could lead to anything, and what she was a maniac who didn't know how to talk to anyone about anything. Also, would he ask her the same? She was sure he already knew the answer. No. No, she had not. Her experience in this department was limited.
To be honest, she had shocked herself in her encounters thus far by having any idea what she was supposed to do at all. It was amazing that she hadn't flopped and flailed or fallen out a window by accident or something during any physical encounter. David was still waiting. It had gone beyond anticipation to that point where the question was starting to break apart like smoke on the wind. There was a ding and a buzz as a text message came in. David didn't reach for the phone in his pocket, but Stevie could feel it against her hip. It buzzed again, like a persistent bee. "Do you want to get that?" she said. Another buzz. The moment had passed. "Is that Izzy?" Stevie asked.
"I don't know. I didn't look."
"You hang out a lot," she said, stepping away from his chest and back.
"Well, yeah. What about it?"
"I didn't say anything about it," Stevie replied.
"You kind of did, because you mentioned it."
Stevie could see clearly that this was going badly, and it was happening fast. Time to turn it around, laugh it off, convert this conversation into something else, a joke, a moment. But David was looking down at her with that slight tilt of the eyebrow that meant he was engaged, and that slight tilt of the eyebrow made him more attractive to her and annoyed her in the same moment. Which meant that there was something in this, and no, she would not be able to let it go. It was a loose tooth that demanded wiggling. A hole in the fabric that required picking and expanding.
No. Make the conversation stop.
"That's all it was. I was just saying."
Her tone was too flat. She invited combat. "She's in my tutorial," he said. "It's just me and Izzy and this guy Graham who keeps loose cheese in his pocket and we think is an online predator, so Izzy and I kind of stick together. I live here right now. There are people here."
"Obviously, there are people here. There are people everywhere. I didn't mean..."
"You did mean. You need to trust me. Do you think that I can't control myself or something? Like I'm not serious about you? What have I done to make you feel like that? Because I've kind of worked hard to stop being fuck up David and be this new one. Also, fuck up David felt the same way about you too and never cheated. I just failed more classes and hung out on the roof more.
Forget it, okay?
I'm actually trying.
So..." David took a beat and nodded. This happened to them sometimes. They went to 100. In fact, her pulse was quickening beyond the point of happy excitement and into the territory of fear. It made her neck throb and electric shocks run down her arms. "Oh, shit," she said.
"What?"
"Not now. Not here. Not this." But that's the thing about an anxiety attack. It shows up when it likes. It barges into the situation and takes over. The world warps.
"Stevie?"
She didn't know what to ask him to do. She fumbled for her bag, yanking the zipper open and feeling around for the keychain that held her emergency anxiety medication.
"Are you sick?"
She shook her head. "Anxiety attack," she said as her fingers found the small container. She unscrewed it, removed the pill, and swallowed it dry.
"Okay,"
he said, scooping his arm around her, giving her support.
"No problem. Walk with me a little. Breathe that stanky air. Smell it? That's cold, nasty river water."
She was a useless piece of human furniture, confused, tucked under his arm. Were other people looking at them? What did they make of her? They were in the other world, the one that made sense.
"Just take it easy,"
David was saying close to her ear.
"Breathe nice and slow."
As if it was that easy. But she tried. She knew it worked. She knew it would end, and all the things that had fallen over would be put back in place, and the world would reassemble itself. She had been through this many times. Not usually in public, though. This tended to happen more before bed or when she was asleep. When she could break apart in private, climb under the sheets, rest on the floor, pace from familiar wall to familiar wall. This was London. Dark and bright and loud and strange, and there was only David to cling to in this moment. He was her only guidepost as they walked back to the tube and made their way through the clamor and bright lights of the station. On the train, she had to turn and put her face into his shoulder,
because the view out the window was too much. The whoosh through the tunnel, the bright subway ads flashing by, taunting her with offers for travel insurance, human-sized pictures of chocolate bars, better phone rates, all the flotsam and jetsam of life. Numbers and houses and futures and food. Why did all this stuff have to fly into her face? Who needed it all? Why go this fast?
Breathe,
David was saying.
I'm breathing,
she mumbled. She was breathing. In and out. That was one for the win column. She was breathing. Her therapist had told her this was the thing to grab onto. You are breathing. You are okay. Grab hold of your breath. Make the exhales longer than the inhales. That was all she had to do. In for four. Hold for five. Out for six. Her own warm breath cocooned her against his coat. It was a blanket, something she could grab with her hand and understand. She had her own breath and a handful of coat, and she was going to take those two things and put the planet back together with them. This was how they got back to Craven House. By the time they arrived, the medicine was starting to take effect. Things were still racing, but they were slowing down. She pressed close to David, but her knees were more stable, her gait more regular. The lights didn't strobe at her quite so much. She was almost able to enjoy the moment, her body against David's, the way he held her. He said nothing as he helped her into the elevator, then down the hall. Nate's door was open, and he looked up as David came in with a stunned-looking Stevie.
What's going on?
Nate asked.
No big deal,
David said, taking the key that Stevie was fumbling with and helping her open the door.
Are you drunk?
Stevie shook her head heavily and stepped into the half-lit room. The medicine she'd taken would knock her out soon enough. She shrugged off her coat and let it fall to the floor, then climbed into the bed, the plasticky mattress squeaking as she huddled under the duvet. Her thoughts kaleidoscoped in her mind's eye. The streets of London, the view of the bridge, the socioeconomic realities of 1880s London, and the taste of garlic on David's lips. Izzy and her aunt and the lock on the door, her stubbornness. David's face. His long, angular face. The softness of his coat and the warmth of his breath, it all blended together and rode along the tracks made by the ambient light coming through the blinds and slicing up the wall. And then, the full effect of the medication kicked in. And everything faded out.
Excerpt from the witness statement of Susanna Rillington. 24 June, 1995. Interviewer.
If you could take us through the night, please, starting with this game you were all playing. Where did you go when the game started?
Susanna Rillington.
I went outside through the back, out the mudroom door. The gardens here are vast. I thought the back garden was a good place to start. There's a yew maze back there.
Did anyone go that way with you?
Julian did, but we went separate ways once we got out.
Where did you go?
I ran around the back garden for a few minutes, but I couldn't find anywhere that seemed suitable to hide. I ended up in the walled garden on the north side of the house. It has an edge of shrubbery lining the inside. I wedged my way in there.
Do you know when you were found?
It felt like ages standing there in the rain, but I don't know when it was.
And who found you?
Peter. I had just come out to move again when he came through the garden. That's the trick. Don't move.
And you were taken to the Folly to get a new poncho?
Yes. And then I started seeking.
Were you ever by the woodshed at any point when you were hiding or seeking?
I went past it a few times, but I didn't check it. It was locked.
How do you know that?
Sebastian told us. All the outbuildings were locked. I walked past that area, but I didn't really look at it. I think I would have noticed if the door was open and the wheelbarrow was out. I feel I can say that for certain.
At any point when you were outside, did you see Rosie or Noel?
I think I may have seen Noel running through the back gardens when the game started, but I'm not sure. Noel's quite a good climber. He may have been going for the trees. I don't know, though.
When would this have been?
I don't know. Early on.
Did you see which door he used to leave the house?
No.
And the game itself ended when?
There was this tremendous lightning and a thunderclap, and all the lights in the house went out. Right after that, we all decided to go back inside. We didn't want to be hit by lightning, and we needed a fire and a drink anyway.
Do you know what time this was?
I think around 2:30. There's a grandfather clock in the entryway hall. It chimes on the half hour and hour. I remember it making a noise soon after we came in, because the hall was dark, and it was quite an eerie sound.
And Rosie and Noel never came in?
No. We thought they were off together somewhere. Romantically, I mean. They had been getting closer over the last week, and we thought they were out having a night together. So best to leave them to it.
Romantically?
Yes.
And that was recent?
Yes. Rosie had been... Well, she'd been dating Julian up until recently.
There had been a breakup?
Yes. Julian is a bit of a Lothario. Rosie had had enough.
She split from Julian?
Yes, but he wouldn't... I mean, if you're suggesting that...
I'm not suggesting anything. We're merely trying to ascertain the facts.
Julian is a tomcat. Everyone is used to his ways. This sort of thing happens a lot with us. We may get mad at each other, but the most violent thing that's ever happened was Rosie pouring